Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the some version of Everybody Hates Cleveland, the podcast on waitingfornextyear.com. It's two very long names of two very somewhat complex brands, which you won't remember. Nevertheless, without Jim Pete tonight, who really is the facilitator, Gage and I are going to try and talk a little bit of Indians, specifically the deals of the prior 2 weeks. That is Edwin Encarnacion, Carlos Santana-centric deal, the salary dump of Yonder Alonso, and the late arrival of the third player prospect and player to be named in a Yan Gomes deal. So first, let's talk about the big headliner. We have the Indians dealing for Carlos Santana, and then almost in like a tertiary or second deal, with the only tie being some money being sent from Tampa Bay to Seattle, we have the Indians acquiring Jake Bowers in exchange for Yandy Diaz and Cole Sulcer.
We're really down Jim tonight, who is the master facilitator. But I want to get your thoughts on Santana first, because I kind of want to pivot mine off there. Do you see it as more of a salary dump, or is it more of optimizing the roster this year? How do you see that one?
I don't know. I obviously was lower on it than most people when it first happened, and my mind has changed a lot. I think now that you've moved Alonso and his entire salary and actually gotten an asset back, which is pretty awesome, I think it makes a lot more sense, because if you're changing out Carlos Santana for Edwin Encarnacion DH, that's a significant downgrade. If you're putting Carlos in, you know, and Yonder Alonso is still playing DH or something like that. But Carlos Santana at first base is valuable. He gets on base a ton. He plays really solid defense. And he's a solid base runner. And the other thing is, he can't be exploited on one side or the other, which was true of Alonso and somewhat true of Encarnacion, and I think could become more true of Encarnacion. I don't know if people remember, but there was that first half and second half with Mike Napoli where you could tell that he really raked his first half by just sort of like exploiting certain things and being over aggressive to make up for the fact that his swing speed and ultimate like pitch recognition was in decline. And I think there's a pretty good argument that Enwin could be hitting that tipping point. So I understand that part of the deal. So I think there is an argument to be made that Carlos Santana is just more valuable to the Indians in 2019 and also way cheaper.
So, I mean, for clarity's sake, they didn't dump money in the deal. They added $4 million to overall, because Seattle spent $5 million, but they spread it out over the next 2 years, which is a big thing for them. I want to play devil's advocate a little bit on the Encarnacion thing, because I'm kind of more with you, but the projection systems love him still. They still love that 120 weighted runs created plus, and you got Baseball Prospectus's new deserved runs created plus that really values the heck out of Encarnacion. And I guess I don't know what to think, because I saw what you saw last year with kind of him being exploited, and there were a lot of fastballs that were up in the zone that he was either just late on or just off on a tick. But people still, some smarter people than I, seem to really think that he's still got something left in the tank. And I don't think it's a crazy bet to say that he's going to be a tad more productive hitting than Carlos Santana in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a reach, but let's... He ran the lowest walk rate of his career since 2009 in 2018, and he ran the highest strikeout rate of his career of any full season in 2018. So that to me is pretty discouraging in terms of his offense. I think that's a place we often see aging happen. And for someone like Encarnacion, a declining walk rate and increased efficiency and contact's kind of a big deal. So I think that's the counterpoint. He's turning 30. Is he turning 37? 36. He's going to be 36 at the start of the season, and he's coming off his worst offensive season since 2010. So I think 2011. So I think there is pretty significant reason to say that the Indians did very well, because Santana has tools other than offense. Edwin just has to be perfect offensively. He has to be good.
And yeah, and I want to laud the Indians for getting out from that too. At the same time, in the same breath, you owed him $20 million. If you're really hard capped at $120 to $130 million, I mean, they're under that even now, but you owed him $20 million and then $5 million as a buyout for next year because you were never picking up that option. So now you turn that into somebody who's a safer play in Santana because of his ability to field and run the bases a little bit. And you just bought him in for an extra year. I was kind of surprised Seattle sent some money back in it, to be honest. It seemed like they're taking on the bulk there. And I couldn't figure out where that deal was enticing for them, really.
Those draft compensation picks, man. Draft compensation picks. I mean, I guess the positive is almost all the salary they took back, right, Tampa Bay covered.
Right. Correct.
So I guess that's, in essence, they sent about $1 million with the Indians. So I guess that makes sense. And I think, all right, let's talk about the secondary pieces, because I think everybody has a take on Carlos Santana versus Edwin Encarnacion, and really, who wants to have a conversation about that? So I'm going to ask you about the most interesting player in all these deals, and that guy is Cole Sulcer. Indians gave up Sulcer along with Yandy Diaz to acquire Jake Bowers. I'm joking about Sulcer, but he's fascinating. He ran elite K rates the last 2 years in AAA, and while he's had a history of pretty mediocre walk rates, he's a super interesting prospect for a team that knows how to collect talent. So,
do you have a Sulcer? He just never heard. He didn't have much name recognition or buzz along with him, but it just seemed like when you're teetering on that AAA edge for a couple years and you don't really break through, especially with as bad as the bullpen was last year, there's got to be something organizationally that they just don't trust there, right?
I think so. I mean, because this organization hasn't developed a reliever in since Cody Allen, who's now basically incompetent.
So maybe Kevin Cash of the Rays saw something that he liked and insisted on getting him back. That's the only theory that I can muster with Sulcer. I don't know a whole lot about him, to be honest. But if when you're a 28-year-old that can't get a shot in the majors when your bullpen was as bad as the Indians was last year, there's something that just doesn't sit right with me prospect-wise.
I know, but I'll tell you, John Edwards, he seems like a really good whatever.
Whenever you can load up on dudes that throw 93 with one mediocre secondary pitch in the bullpen, you just got to, huh?
All right. I guess we have to talk about Jake Bowers, who I just wrote a bunch of words about, and unfortunately a lot of people are reading it, so that's on you, folks. I thought about this, and I think the only insightful thing I might have said was that this is pretty fascinating as a challenge trade. I think this is a situation where you often don't see teams trade closest to a one-for-one, because Sulcer's a throw-in and the Indians are in some ways getting $5 million out of the Rays here because that facilitates their deal with the Mariners. So I think it's fascinating because you have the Indians saying basically we have a ton of information on Yandy Diaz and we just like Jake Bowers better. And so I guess one of the questions is it just that Jake Bowers is a better fit and that he's more flexible to play the outfield? Does it have to do with some of the Yandy Diaz baggage that we won't discuss on air today? Or does it have to do with the fact that, hey, maybe Jake Bauer's profile is pretty fascinating?
I mean, I think it's all of it. I you know, I love Yandy, and I don't want to get into that, but there must be something that the front office, not even just Tito, if they're so willing to deal with him, and maybe they love Jake Bowers, and maybe it's more on that side, but he just never got his chance. He wasn't an Aguilar type to me. He wasn't a Jesus Aguilar type who never got his chance because he seemed like he was just never a fit. And now he went to Milwaukee and boomed. We all know that. But Yandy, they had a million chances to play him last year, and they just refused to until their hand was forced, it felt like. So, and maybe it is the Bowers thing. And Mike's piece is great, if you haven't read it yet, which I think all of Cleveland has. But
I love it. It's great. People need to feed my ego.
It's great. He talks about Bowers as a bet, and he did mention a challenge trade, and he highlights that in his piece, but kind of begging the other team to get more out of the prospect that they gave up, and I like that phrase.
I guess with Diaz, I've loved him and backed him forever. There's an extent to which they never got him to elevate the ball, and his floor is awesome even when he's not elevating the ball, but there's just such a clear ceiling. And one of the other problems that I think is under-discussed is that he just doesn't pull the ball. Like, even when he puts the ball in the air, he doesn't pull the ball in the air. And so there's definitely a contact point problem, but I just think a huge extent of Diaz's whole profile is that at some point you're going to have to sell walks for power, because he lives on getting an extra something of a second by using the opposite field at a huge proportion, which kills the balls you hit in the air because you get an inverse spin when you go the other way that sort of kills the flight. So I just think there's an extent to Diaz, who I love and think is going to be a good big league player, that, I mean, I think it's a worthwhile challenge. And I also think he's 27 and you traded him in for a guy who's 22 and has had the same success at the big league level in a similar sample. And that's pretty cool. I think one of the things that I always want to hammer home whenever I see people tweeting about prospects and them being limited to being utility players or, you know, limited to these things or whatever, is just like, always first, just look at their age and when they're at the level. And if somebody is just destroying their way to the big leagues at 22 years old, and rakes in double A at 20 and 21, you better pay attention, because that guy can make adjustments. And I think that's the sort of thing you see with Bowers, where the Indians are just betting on someone who's always had success and has some solid tools making adjustments.
Yeah, and I do want to make the flip side point of that, where you said Diaz doesn't pull the ball. You look at Bowers' profile, he pulls the ball like crazy.
And too much.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's been kind of tilting up there past that happy medium tipping point the past couple of years. But maybe there's something in there that they're betting on. I mean, I know scouts had him at like a 55 raw power, but maybe they're betting on him not being capped out at 15 homers. Maybe they think there's a 25 homer capability with that plate recognition and ability to get around on the ball.
I think there is. I think there's 25 in there in Cleveland. I think he's going to hit 20 this year and have a 330 OBP. And like, in left field, what's that, 5% worse than Michael Brantley, except Bowers doesn't need multiple hip replacements and, I don't know, insure when he gets out of bed in the morning.
And not to mention, I think he can cover some ground. I know his speed. I don't think the scouts had his speed off the charts, but it's another underrated aspect of him that I want to get to real quick. This guy's stolen 20 bases a year, every year since 2015.
Yeah, so he's the other thing that, like, I don't know, this is annoying, but like, he's a tireless worker and he's 23 and he's in the big leagues. He's not one of these guys who like people throw tireless worker on because he's like 26 and spent 3 years in AAA and we're trying to come up with a reason to call him up. like all the reports about like him putting in work, like he loses a bunch of weight so he can play left and right and create versatility. And oh, versatility is like one of the most important assets in Major League Baseball now. So yeah, that's a big deal. Well, so I think,
never mind, but keep going.
But anyway, so I just think that's absolutely huge. And so like, he just has all these things. I have all these key points that I'm like, I want to see a guy who has great play discipline. I want to see a guy who has good K rates at agent level. I want to see all these things. I want to see people who can make adjustments. I want to hear good work ethics. And it's like, that's every box. And some of these don't pay off. I mean, maybe he's just a 100 WRC plus hitter, like a league average hitter for the next 5 years. And the Indians missed. But I think there's a lot to bet on in terms of him making a leap. And sometimes that's what you have to do, because you were doing the same thing with Yandy Diaz, except he was 27. And there were some issues in the organization with how he related to the manager. And I mean, those don't matter, but like, you do this. You go play, you go make the play for Jake Bowers.
Yeah, and let's say they did with that. That brings us to the versatility part that you hit on. Yandy, it was clear the organization was never going to put him in the outfield. And it was clear that that was kind of a shaky spot for him. I'm not saying he couldn't play it, but it's just not what he knew. So I guess it comes down to Yandy at third base and Jason Kipnis in left field, or Jason Kipnis at second base, where he can be serviceable, no matter what anybody will try to tell me. And Jake Bowers covering ground in the outfield. And now you have two guys that are comfortable with where they are, with no major deficiencies, rather than trying to patrol Kipnis and his noodle arm in right field or left field even. I like the Bowers play a lot, especially after reading your piece and kind of digging into some of his batted ball profile, even though we have pointed out he's a little weaker on the contact authority side than one might like. But it's interesting because he's kind of like a flip side to the other guys that they've acquired, which we'll get to.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it.
So let's move into today. It came out that the player to be named later from the Yan Gomes deal was Andrew Monasterio. And I don't know if it's Andrew or Andrew. He spells it like Andrew Jones. But he's a guy that was in the Cubs system for a while, went over to Washington in exchange for Daniel Murphy last summer. And I want to serve this one up on a tee to my boy Mike. He's a 21-year-old in high A. Where do we think we go from there?
Yeah, he was 20 for most of the season in high A this year, and he makes a ton of contact, and he walks a bunch. He's really disciplined. And yeah, the power isn't there yet, but he's a middle infielder, so that's okay. I love bets like these. And he's a phenomenal athlete. I mean, we have like really solid speed grades on him. He's really a solid athlete. And he knows how to control the bat. And guys who know how to control the bat at 20 know how to control the bat at 24 when they're a little bigger. And they know how to put the ball in the air when they need to.
Aren't those all the middle infield breakouts you hear about?
Yep. Hey, I'm in love with this. This is the best asset they got back. They got go ahead.
Okay, come on, don't dog Jeffrey.
Jeffrey's fun. There's cool stuff there. I just love how much they're just gambling on different tools and different profiles. Like Daniel Johnson is this player who like strikes out way too much. But other than that, he has monster power, he's a great athlete, and he might be able to defend like plus in right field. Like, oh, Jeffrey Rodriguez has an elite fastball and maybe a good secondary. And then you're like, oh, this guy makes insane contact and is a good athlete at 20 and A-plus ball. That's awesome. Those are three really good different types of prospect tickets.
See, I find it kind of funny that he was traded for Daniel Murphy last year. Because if you look at his profile, it is Daniel Murphy light in the minors. It's just like the same kind of frame, maybe not the power that you would hope for there, But Murphy was always a guy who had great pitch recognition. You talk about Jose Ramirez. You talk about any middle infielder breakout. It's always that same mold. So, I mean, he's a small guy. I think he's only, I guess he's 6 foot, but he's pretty thin. He can add some pounds and maybe some power develops there. But like you said, you just got to love the bet on guys who can recognize the zone the best. So where do you think he starts the year?
I think we see him in Double A. I think we're going to see Monasterio and Alex Call in Double A, although Call might get Triple A, but I'm betting Double A. But like Monasterio. Hello and welcome to the some version of Everybody Hates Cleveland, the podcast on waitingfornextyear.com. It's two very long names of two very somewhat complex brands, which you won't remember. Nevertheless, without Jim Pete tonight, who really is the facilitator, Gage and I are going to try and talk a little bit of Indians, specifically the deals of the prior 2 weeks. That is Edwin Encarnacion, Carlos Santana-centric deal, the salary dump of Yonder Alonso, and the late arrival of the third player prospect and player to be named in a Yan Gomes deal. So first, let's talk about the big headliner. We have the Indians dealing for Carlos Santana. And then almost in like a tertiary or second deal, with the only tie being some money being sent from Tampa Bay to Seattle, we have the Indians acquiring Jake Bowers in exchange for Yandy Diaz and Cole Sulcer.
We're really down Jim tonight, who is the master facilitator. But I want to get your thoughts on Santana first, because I kind of want to pivot mine off there. Do you see it as more of a salary dump, or is it more of a optimizing the roster this year? How do you see that one?
I don't know. I obviously was lower on it than most people when it first happened, and my mind has changed a lot. I think now that you've moved Alonso and his entire salary and actually gotten an asset back, which is pretty awesome, I think it makes a lot more sense, because if you're changing out Carlos Santana for Edwin Encarnacion DH, that's a significant downgrade. If you're putting Carlos in, you know, and Yonder Alonso is still playing DH or something like that. But Carlos Santana at first base is valuable. He gets on base a ton. He plays really solid defense. And he's a solid base runner. And the other thing is, he can't be exploited on one side or the other, which was true of Alonso and somewhat true of Encarnacion. And I think could become more true of Encarnacion. I don't know if people remember, but there was that first half and second half with Mike Napoli where you could tell that he's really raked his first half by just sort of like exploiting certain things and being over aggressive to make up for the fact that his swing speed and ultimate like pitch recognition was in decline. And I think there's a pretty good argument that Enwin could be hitting that tipping point. So I understand that part of the deal. So I think there is an argument to be made that Carlos Santana is just more valuable to the Indians in 2019 and also way cheaper.
So, I mean, for clarity's sake, they didn't dump money in the deal. They added $4 million to overall because Seattle spent $5 million. But they spread it out over the next 2 years, which is a big thing for them. And I want to play devil's advocate a little bit on the Encarnacion thing, because I'm kind of more with you, but the projection systems love him still. They still love that 120 weighted runs created plus, and you got Baseball Prospectus's new deserved runs created plus that really values the heck out of Encarnacion. And I guess I don't know what to think, because I saw what you saw last year with kind of him being exploited, and there were a lot of fastballs that were up in the zone that he was either just late on or just off on a tick. But people still, some smarter people than I, seem to really think that he's still got something left in the tank. And I don't think it's a crazy bet to say that he's going to be a tad more productive hitting than Carlos Santana in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a reach, but let's He ran the lowest walk rate of his career since 2009 in 2018, and he ran the highest strikeout rate of his career of any full season in 2018. So that to me is pretty discouraging in terms of his offense. I think that's a place we often see aging happen. And for someone like Encarnacion, a declining walk rate and increased efficiency in contact is kind of a big deal. So I think that's the counterpoint. He's turning 30. Is he turning 37? 36. He's going to be 36 at the start of the season, and he's coming off his worst offensive season since 2010. So I think 2011. So I think there is pretty significant reason to say that the Indians did very well, because Santana has tools other than offense. Edwin just has to be perfect offensively. He has to be good.
And yeah, I want to laud the Indians for getting out from that too. At the same time, in the same breath, you owed him $20 million. If you're really hard capped at $120 to $130 million, I mean, they're under that even now, but you owed him $20 million and then $5 million as a buyout for next year because you were never picking up that option. So now you turn that into somebody who's a safer play in Santana because of his ability to field and run the bases a little bit. And you just bought him in for an extra year. I was kind of surprised Seattle sent some money back in it, to be honest. It seemed like they're taking on the bulk there, and I couldn't figure out where that deal was enticing for them, really.
Those draft compensation picks, man. Draft compensation picks. I mean, I guess the positive is almost all the salary they took back, right, Tampa Bay covered.
Right. Correct.
I guess that's, in essence, they sent about $1 million with the Indians. So I guess that makes sense. And I think, all right, let's talk about the secondary pieces, because I think everybody has a take on Carlos Santana versus Edwin Encarnacion, and really, who wants to have a conversation about that? So I'm going to ask you about the most interesting player in all these deals, and that guy is Cole Sulcer. The Indians gave up Sulcer along with Yandy Diaz to acquire Jake Bowers. I'm joking about Sulcer, but he's fascinating. He ran elite K rates the last 2 years in AAA, and while he's had a history of pretty mediocre walk rates, he's a super interesting prospect for a team that knows how to collect talent. So,
do you have a salt? And he just never hurt. He didn't have much name recognition or buzz along with him, but it just seemed like when you're teetering on that AAA edge for a couple of years and you don't really break through, especially with as bad as the bullpen was last year, there's got to be something organizationally that they just don't trust there, right?
I think so. I mean, because this organization hasn't developed a reliever in, like, well, since Cody Allen, who's now basically incompetent.
So maybe Kevin Cash of the Rays saw something that he liked and insisted on getting him back. That's the only theory that I can muster with Sulcer. I don't know a whole lot about him, to be honest. But if when you're a 28-year-old that can't get a shot in the majors when your bullpen was as bad as the Indians was last year, there's something that just doesn't sit right with me prospect-wise.
I know, but I'll tell you, John Edwards, he seems like a really good whatever.
Whenever you can load up on dudes that throw 93 with one mediocre secondary pitch in the bullpen, you just got to, huh?
All right. I guess we have to talk about Jake Bowers, who I just wrote a bunch of words about. And unfortunately, a lot of people are reading it, so that's on you, folks. I thought about this, and I think the only insightful thing I might have said was that this is pretty fascinating as a challenge trade. I think this is a situation where you often don't see teams trade closest to a one-for-one, because Sulcer's a throw-in, and the Indians are in some ways getting $5 million out of the Rays here, because that facilitates their deal with the Mariners. So I think it's fascinating because you have the Indians saying, basically, we have a ton of information on Yandy Diaz and we just like Jake Bowers better. And so I guess one of the questions is it just that Jake Bowers is a better fit and that he's more flexible to play the outfield? Does it have to do with some of the Yandy Diaz baggage that we won't discuss on air today? Or does it have to do with the fact that, hey, maybe Jake Bowers' profile's pretty fascinating?
I mean, I think it's all of it. I love Yandy, and I don't want to get into that, but there must be something that the front office, not even just Tito, if they're so willing to deal with him, and maybe they love Jake Bowers, and maybe it's more on that side, but he just never got his chance. He wasn't an Aguilar type to me. He wasn't a Jesus Aguilar type who never got his chance because he seemed like he was just never a fit. And now he went to Milwaukee and boomed. We all know that. But Yandy, they had a million chances to play him last year, and they just refused to until their hand was forced, it felt like. So, and maybe it is the Bowers thing. And Mike's piece is great, if you haven't read it yet, which I think all of Cleveland has. But
I love it. Go out there and read it. It's great. People need to feed my ego.
It's great. He talks about Bowers as a bet, and he did mention a challenge trade, and he highlights that in his piece, but kind of begging the other team to get more out of the prospect that they gave up, and I like that phrase.
I guess with Diaz, I've loved him and backed him forever. There's an extent to which they never got him to elevate the ball, and his floor is awesome even when he's not elevating the ball, but there's just such a clear ceiling. And one of the other problems that I think is under-discussed is that he just doesn't pull the ball. Like, even when he puts the ball in the air, he doesn't pull the ball in the air. And so there's definitely a contact point problem, but I just think a huge extent of Diaz's whole profile is that at some point you're going to have to sell walks for power, because he lives on getting an extra something of a second by using the opposite field at a huge proportion, which kills the balls you hit in the air because you get an inverse spin when you go the other way that sort of kills the flight. So I just think there's an extent to Diaz, who I love and think is going to be a good big league player, that I think it's a worthwhile challenge. And I also think he's 27 and you traded him in for a guy who's 22 and has had the same success at the big league level in a similar sample. And that's pretty cool. I think one of the things that I always want to hammer home whenever I see people tweeting about prospects and them being limited to being utility players or, limited to these things or whatever, is just like always first, just look at their age and when they're at the level. And if somebody is just destroying their way to the big leagues at 22 years old, and rakes in double A at 20 and 21, you better pay attention because that guy can make adjustments. And I think that's the sort of thing you see with Bowers, where the Indians are just betting on someone who's always had success and has some solid tools making adjustments.
Yeah, and I do want to make the flip side point of that, where you said Diaz doesn't pull the ball. You look at Bowers' profile, he pulls the ball like crazy.
And too much.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's been kind of tilting up there past that happy medium tipping point the past couple of years. But maybe there's something in there that they're betting on. I mean, I know scouts had him at like a 55 raw power, but maybe they're betting on him not being capped out at 15 homers. Maybe they think there's a 25 homer capability with that plate recognition and ability to get around on the ball.
I think there is. I think there's 25 in there in Cleveland. I think he's going to hit 20 this year and have a 330 OBP. And like in left field, what's that, 5% worse than Michael Brantley, except Bowers doesn't need multiple hip replacements and, I don't know, insure when he gets out of bed in the morning.
And not to mention, I think he can cover some ground. I know his speed. I don't think the scouts had his speed off the charts, but it's another underrated aspect of him that I want to get to real quick. This guy's stolen 20 bases a year, every year since 2015.
The other thing that, like, I don't know, this is annoying, but like, he's a tireless worker and he's 23 and he's in the big leagues. He's not one of these guys who, like, people throw tireless worker on because he's like 26 and spent 3 years in AAA, and we're trying to come up with a reason to call him up. Like, all the reports about, like, him putting in work, like, he loses a bunch of weight so he can play left and right and create versatility. And, oh, versatility is, like, one of the most important assets in Major League Baseball now. So, yeah, that's a big deal. Well, so, I think...
Never mind. But keep going.
But anyway, so I just think that's absolutely huge. And so, like, he just has all these things. I have all these key points that I'm like, I want to see a guy who has great play discipline. I want to see a guy who has good K rates at agent level. I want to see all these things. I want to see people who can make adjustments. I want to hear good work ethics. And it's like, that's every box. And some of these don't pay off. I mean, maybe he's just a 100 WRC plus hitter, like a league average hitter for the next 5 years. And the Indians missed. But I think there's a lot to bet on in terms of him making a leap. And sometimes that's what you have to do, because you were doing the same thing with Yandy Diaz, except he was 27. And there were some issues in the organization with how he related to the manager. And I mean, those don't matter, but like, you do this. You go play, you go make the play for Jake Bowers.
Yeah. And let's say they did with that. That brings us to the versatility part that you hit on. Yandy, it was clear the organization was never going to put him in the outfield. And it was clear that that was kind of a shaky spot for him. I'm not saying he couldn't play it, but it's just not what he knew. So I guess it comes down to Yandy at third base and Jason Kipnis in left field, or Jason Kipnis at second base, where he can be serviceable, no matter what anybody will try to tell me. And Jake Bowers covering ground in the outfield. And now you have two guys that are comfortable with where they are, with no major deficiencies, rather than trying to patrol Kipnis and his noodle arm in right field or left field even. I like the Bowers play a lot, especially after reading your piece and kind of digging into some of his batted ball profile, even though we have pointed out he's a little weaker on the contact authority side than one might like, but it's interesting because he's kind of like a flip side to the other guys that they've acquired, which we'll get to.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it.
So let's move into today. It came out that the player to be named later from the Yan Gomes deal was Andrew Monasterio, and I don't know if it's Andrew or Andrew. He spells it like Andrew Jones. But he's a guy that was in the Cubs system for a while, went over to Washington in exchange for Daniel Murphy last summer. And I want to serve this one up on a tee to my boy Mike. He's a 21-year-old in high A. Where do we think we go from there?
Yeah, he was 20 for most of the season in high A this year, and he makes a ton of contact, and he walks a bunch. He's really disciplined. And yeah, the power isn't there yet, but he's a middle infielder, so that's okay. I love bets like these. And he's a phenomenal athlete. I mean, we have like really solid speed grades on him. He's really a solid athlete. And he knows how to control the bat. And guys who know how to control the bat at 20 know how to control the bat at 24 when they're a little bigger. And they know how to put the ball in the air when they need to.
Aren't those all the middle infield breakouts you hear about?
Yep. Hey, I mean, like, I'm in love with this. This is the best asset they got back. They got – go ahead.
Okay, come on. Don't dog Jeffrey.
Jeffrey's fun. There's cool stuff there. I just love how much they're just gambling on different tools and different profiles. Like, Daniel Johnson is this player who, like, strikes out way too much. But other than that, he has monster power. He's a great athlete, and he might be able to defend, like, plus in right field. It's like, oh, Jeffrey Rodriguez has an elite fastball and maybe a good secondary. And then you're like, oh, this guy makes insane contact and is a good athlete at 20 and A-plus ball. That's awesome. Those are three really good different types of prospect tickets.
See, I find it kind of funny that he was traded for Daniel Murphy last year. Because if you look at his profile, it is Daniel Murphy light in the minors. It's just like the same kind of frame, maybe not the power that you would hope for there. But Murphy was always a guy who had great pitch recognition. You talk about Jose Ramirez, you talk about any middle infielder breakout, it's always that same mold. So, I mean, he's a small guy. I think he's only, I guess he's 6 foot, but he's pretty thin. He can add some pounds and maybe some power develops there. But like you said, you just got to love the bet on guys who can recognize the zone the best. So where do you think he starts the year?
I think we see him in Double A. I think we're going to see Monasterio and Alex Call in Double A, although Call might get Triple A, but I'm betting Double A. But like Monasterio and Daniel Johnson makes Double A a lot more fun immediately. I think the Gomes deal, I really like. I've gotten to the point where like, it's really, this is a lot of different types of flyers and solid prospects for a guy who you can replace 95% of this year and you cleared salary. I mean, I think it makes a ton of sense. Now we're still in this mode where they're not spending any money apparently. So it's another question, but I've pitched my love for Monasterio. You're pretty into Alex Call right now. I'll lay this out first. I'm just thrilled the Indians got somebody back who has a name for Yonder Alonso, because I don't think he has any surplus value. He in 2019, unless it's just like wooing Manny Machado. The other thing that I find kind of funny about this is like, it's his brother-in-law. Like, I don't know. I can't convince any of my brother-in-laws to like, I don't know, do much. And we're supposed to act like Yonder Alonso has some power. It's not like it's his blood brother here. I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's his blood brother. I have no idea. But I guess, whatever. Anyway, go ahead. Alex Call, outfielder, Double A, return for Yonder Alonso.
By the way, I got to step off for a second. There was a report on Alonso wooing Manny Machado earlier today, and it's like, they live two blocks away in Florida. Two blocks away from each other in Florida. Maybe it'll be the same in Chicago. I mean, come on.
Okay.
Do you think Manny Machado $10 million to go play with his brother-in-law in Chicago?
This is the phenomenal question.
That's just bizarre.
How much money would you give up to play on the same baseball team as your brother-in-law for 1 year?
None. Sorry, okay. Kyle. Kyle's my brother-in-law.
Well, that's a good call, because I would not give up any to live next to my brother-in-laws. They're good people. I like them. I'm not giving up $10 million, so what does it matter?
Here's where I want to get back to the Alex Call. Like you said, they got something for Yonder Alonso, who's basically Justin Bour, who just got paid $2.5 million for next year. I don't get what the White Sox are doing. If it is the woo Manny Machado, you just pissed away $7 million because you weren't getting him anyway, or you were getting him anyway if he does come there. But Alex Call, I kind of like him because he just does everything adequately, and maybe that's a knock, but I think when you have a well-rounded prospect, it's not going to be a reason. He's got the can't feel get a disorder leash, but I just kind of like the profile of 50 hit tool, 50 speed, 50 field. I don't want to get into scout grades too much, but it looks like he's made some positive adjustments as he climbs the levels. And the K percentage surging, I can live with as long as that kind of quiets back down as he spends more time at each level. You're the prospect guy. What do you think about a 27% K percentage in his first year in Double A?
You know I don't love it. Nah, it's fine. I mean, he just turned 24, so he's 23 in Double A. That's fine. K percentage is high, but he has all those stats across the board. I guess we're not seeing as much speed as we hope we'd see. But there's good power. He's supposedly a good defender. As an aside, one of the things that's most important to me in my baseball writing evangelism is that people stop talking about arms is really important. Alex Call has a very good arm, but like, that's nice. It's a part of a defensive profile, but to me, it's like there are like 5 to 7 plays a year where an elite arm is really that much more important than an average arm. And it's just such a small amount that I really think that we've talked about arms way too much. I think it's hilarious. I think we do about it with like Tyler Naquin and Lonnie Chisenhall, and we're like, oh my God, what a plus tool. Anyway, this is a stupid rant, but Zimmer. Oh my gosh. It's just so tiring to me because compared to every other tool, it's so unimpactful. And I think we live in this 5-tool model where like the arm has always been like that 5th tool. And honestly, I don't care.
I have a theory about that. I want to get into this real quick. I think we fall in love with the arm so much because baseball is not a GIF or JIF, however you don't want to pronounce it, friendly sport until you get somebody throwing somebody out at home plate.
That's fine. I'm okay with that. That's a good theory.
And I think it's a sexy, more of like a nice to rather than a need to, and people kind of flock to, because it's just a very aesthetically pleasing play rather than running a ball down at full sprint, which can be fun too, but the great defenders in the outfield make the hard plays look easy, and those defensive runs saved don't show up like they do when you're gunning the guy out at the plate.
So this is a dark take. This is part of the reason I'm like super down on Bradley Zimmer in general, and we loved his like first year DRS, defensive run saves. But like a lot of his value is all from throwing, and I don't think that's completely wrong. Like I think he's a good athlete and everything, but like we're gonna see him in another year with wear and tear on that body, and that dude has to be a plus defender to make it at the big league level at this point, unless he finally figures something out offensively. And I don't buy it. Use this moment to trash Bradley Zimmer because it kind of bothers Gage, and that's what I'm here for.
I'm one of the lone Zimmer holdouts, I think, but I remember that game in Detroit where his defense was shining, and that sticks out in my memory. And maybe that's not fair. Maybe you're more right than I am. I just think those stupidly fast guys, the taller guys with bigger strides, make things look easy. That it's almost like watching like a Terrell Pryor run down the sideline at Ohio State. It's like you take 2 steps and get 6 or 7 yards, and then people are just, it doesn't look that fast. I think that's a little bit of the Zimmer thing for me in the outfield. I think he flies around. But the wear and tear is a good point. I'm kind of worried about how he comes back from the shoulder issues.
I like to dunk on Zimmer because I've been talking about his K rate issues since like A-plus ball, and people were like, no, it's fine. He's a hit tool. And you know what? I like to be right sometimes. And now he's going to have a great season and prove me wrong, and I'll be happy to. But I do like to be right. It's very important to me. Anyway.
And I like to go the other way because I fell on the other side of the Zimmer versus Frazier debate that was akin to LeBron, MJ for a while they were flying up through the Indian system. I was always a Zimmer guy more than a Frazier guy, but.
Give me the Frazier fur. I came with my Christmas pun game. So I'm drinking a 12 Dogs of Christmas ale right now, and it's just way too sweet. So that's me telling you this beer is just, I don't know what it is, but it isn't a beer. Let's talk about some just off the wall ideas. At what level of deal that Manny Machado gets does Francisco Lindor say, oh snap, maybe I should take that like 2-year extension in Cleveland? Like, what does Machado have to get before Lindor starts to think maybe the guaranteed money helps?
I mean, is it like $250 million where he gets some 9-year, $250 million without a ton of player opt-outs? I don't know. I have a hard time seeing the scenario where Lindor decides to sign an extension in Cleveland. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense with his New Balance money and his arbitration costs coming his way now, because he's going to make probably $50 million over the next 3 years in arbitration, don't you think?
Yeah, but how much money is really New Balance money? I mean, this is, they're just like two steps above K-Swiss. How much money can New Balance money be?
Like, I mean, but, I don't know. Shameless plug. When I was a basketball manager for Ohio State, and I remember Evan Turner coming out of there and getting a deal with Lining out of China. I don't know how much that was for, but I know he did pretty well. So,
all right,
rocking Lining gear. So I'm sure New Balance. I don't think Lindor is begging for more pennies from him.
Did you get any Lining gear out of that?
I did. Imagine. I got a pair of Lining basketball shoes.
Man, that's pretty dope. Okay, I'm going to make a pitch here because I've said basically that Lindor is like gone for the last 2 years. But I'm kind of starting to see a scenario where maybe he isn't. So the first part is this. Machado is just 26. Lindor doesn't hit free agency until he is 28. So you're 2 years older, and Machado just got 9 years, 250. And the Indians walk up to you and say, hey, we'll buy out the next 3 years at $20 million apiece, or 22. So that's $66 million. So they're willing to overpay on the front end. And then they say, we want two more option years, and we want them at $30 million apiece. So that's another $60 million. So you offer him $126 million for 2 extra years of control when he just saw Machado go out there, 2 years younger than him, higher peak season than him. Actually, that's not true. God damn it.
No, that's not true.
All right, fine. He's not signing in Cleveland. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Well, the Indians are probably going to lose their franchise in 8 years to Portland. Let's move on to the next topic.
Jesus, we got dark. let me ask you this. Do you think Machado, I know he was hurt by some BABIP issues in 2017, but do you think that 2.5 WAR season in 2017 is going to hurt him at all this week or this month?
I don't know. I mean, he's 26 and he has 30 career WAR. I don't know.
So, I don't know if it's a homer in me or if it's just – I think Lindor is a step up from Machado. And it's not a knock on Machado at all. And Machado has obviously had a better peak hitting season than him.
Mm-hmm.
But Lindor's fielding baseline, even though we see some weird take plays off here and there or focus errors, as you like to call them, I think. I just kind of like the Francisco Lindor profile more. Machado, I guess they're pretty similar, but feels like his defense is a safer bet, and that is a skill that's going to stick with him for the next 4 or 5 years at least. So I don't know. You bring it up because theoretically, in my head, I think Lindor is a little better as a player, but then you look at the numbers, and they're not all that different. So.
It's a fair point. What we're really saying is
we have no idea.
Yep. Absolutely no idea. All right. So we've covered everything we needed to cover. So like what take do you have right now that you haven't discussed publicly that we kind of need to break down? Like what's been burning in your mind about the 2019 Cleveland Indians?
How we've walked through all these rumors. And some free agents have signed here and there, but we have no idea who the Indians are going to pursue on the relief pitching market, or if they are. We saw them burn that bridge last winter where they just said, F it, let's not sign any relievers. And let's just roll with Miller and Allen, who simultaneously imploded in one of the most important seasons of the Indians' window. Why isn't there any interest in relief pitchers? Like, why is Trevor Rosenthal being traded for a bag of peanuts last month and the Indians? I just don't – that's the part I don't get. Where is the relief pitching going to come from in 2019?
What do you think – yeah, I have no idea. It's Adam Ottavino. But where do you think, what do you think of this market compared to last year? Last year was a market that we saw and we were like, holy crap, the Indians signed Alonso really early, spent most of their WAD, and then you saw player after player go for under market deal, basically. This year we've seen Patrick Corbin go for 6 and 140, which is an insanely good deal for him to take. Saw Joe Kelly go for 3 and 25, which is a decent deal, but it doesn't seem that overwhelming. I'm not a huge Brantley Gamble fan, but 2 and 32 for Michael Brantley is a really pretty cheap, riskless play if you're anybody but the Indians or a small market team.
So I want to hit on the Brantley thing real quick too, because I'm surprised he couldn't get a third year.
Yeah.
I know the injury, but isn't he younger than Pollock? Is he a year older? They're around the same age.
Pollock's just a tick younger.
The only deal that's really floored me was McCutchen getting $50 million.
That one was fascinating. And I think last offseason where we saw Todd Frazier get 2 and 18, the McCutchen deal looks friggin' nuts, especially because Kane got, what did he get? 5 for 70, which next to the McCutchen deal looks insanely cheap. I think it's a fascinating offseason. But we also saw the early moves last offseason be the most outlandish. I love Carlos Santana, but like 3 and 60 for Santana in that offseason was pretty fascinating. And proved to be kind of an overpay based on where it went. I don't know. Does Marwin Gonzalez or Pollock just fall to them at a number they like enough to do it?
I don't know about Marwin. It feels like there's a lot of interest around him from what I've seen. But Pollock, I mentioned this in the text. I know the Indians don't have a bunch of free cash running around if we're to believe what's being fed to us by the national media and some local media. But what's stopping them from waiting to see if he falls out and then just saying, hey, you want to take that qualifying offer that you turned down again? Come play with us a year for $19 million.
Well, I also just think there's a situation where it's really easy to get him for like 3 and 42. Like, I don't think that's out of the picture, because when you have draft pick compensation tied to you, that depresses your like earnings by what, 5 to 7 million?
Yeah, but is he going to get the $50 million bar?
It's a very, very, very good question.
That was a pretty low risk qualifying offer for the Diamondbacks to yield out, I think. I don't know. I could see him getting 3 for 50 if McCutchen got 3 for 50, but I could also see him, like you said, down at the 3 for 40 range. I expect him to sign for 3 years. I don't see any more than that.
This market is like so slow, and you have enough pieces like Machado. You have these big markets acting like they're not going to exceed the luxury tax by much. And so you have Machado and Harper, and New York's going to pop one of them, right? Or LA is going to pop one of them.
Yeah.
And there's just going to be guys waiting around on January 2nd, and we don't know who it is. Maybe it's January 15th. But I think Pollock could be one of those guys, and I think Marwin could be too. I just think it's a fundamentally strange offseason. I think we're seeing player spending go down a little bit in general, which is a larger issue, but I don't know.
So I got two theories on those guys that are going to be sitting around waiting for those contract offers. I think Jed Lowry might be a name you see thrown around there. I would like him for the Indians. I mean, being 34, I think, is what might make teams hesitant to give him any money. But Jed Lowry, and then I've been saying this since the summer, but Nick Markakis feels like such an Indians move.
Oh, God. Please, no.
I mean, you can't. If, let's say you keep Bauer and Kluber, you have no other avenues. Is if you can get Nick Markakis at 2 years, $15 million, is that, or 2 years, $12 million, something like that? Is that a better than what you have right now? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Oh God. I don't know. I think at the end of the day, if the Indians dealt Encarnacion for some relief, Alonso and Gomes. Encarnacion, Gomes is a big offensive step down, and Brantley walked out the door. And I just think you have to trade a starter if you want your offense to be as good or better than 2018. Now, I see no way around it. And so we can talk about Markakis, and he's durable, and he's not going to embarrass himself at the plate. And he's in that David Murphy zone of the career where, like, you don't even know why he puts a glove on anymore, but he can still hit right-handed pitching. But if we're doing that, I mean, the front office and the Dolans are going to get torched, and they absolutely deserve it.
I agree. I worked into something where I feel like you have to trade Kluber Bauer now. I've sold myself on the you only need four starters for the playoffs anyway.
Yep.
And we don't really have to worry about the Twins. I don't care if they go out and sign Nelson Cruz. I feel like you have to shift it somehow to try to make your team a playoff roster. Forget the regular season. That stuff will handle itself. I don't see how you do it without moving Kluber or Bauer. And I've made this point, but I'd rather move Kluber, but that's just me. Jim's not here to defend himself.
So the really fun part to me is that the most obvious chain of events is that the Dodgers sign Harper and we trade Corey Kluber for Cody Bellinger. And we're done. I mean, that's a lineup I really like. I have Carlos Santana, Cody Bellinger, Jose Ramirez, Francisco Lindor, other players, I suppose. I have, you know, Bowers hitting like sixth or seventh. You know, that's an offense that makes some sense to me. I do wonder, second hypothesis, the Indians go and sign someone like, I mean, I don't know what his status is, but like a CJ Krohn type to play DH? Or are we going to have a rotational DH? Because the Indians need to buy some cheap offense right now, right? Like, they really need just more offense. And the easiest way for them to do it is, like, you've gotten rid of Alonso and Edwin. Santana's going to play first base because he's a good defender. DH is empty. Are they going to go spend, like, $5 million on a cheapish guy to DH?
So this is my favorite scenario to play out, is if the Dodgers get Harper, they trade Bellinger to the Indians for Kluber, and then the Indians go out and sign an Ottavino, and then they sign somebody to come in and hit. Like, let's say the bottom falls out for Jed Lowry. Like, isn't that a sexy offseason?
Nelson Cruz. What do you think about Nelson Cruz?
I would give him $24 million to come be a permanent DH for the next 2 years. I don't care if he's 38. His power's not going anywhere.
Good Lord, he is old. He has had a very sneaky good career. Pour one out for Nelson Cruz, man. That dude is balling.
Drug test him.
Yeah, seriously.
It's really impressive how well he's sustained that power and just the overall profile. Because, I mean, he hasn't seen a dip in walks, and he struck out less last year than he ever had before. Like, he's 38 years old, still hitting 40 bombs.
My Lord. He's like the most quiet person to 360 dingers I've ever heard of. Like, he's probably going to get to 400, and we just, like, never talk about Nelson Cruz.
Well, it's because 90% of those things came after he was 30.
This is a fair point. All right.
It's amazing. I don't think I've ever seen anybody who, let's see, he hit the bigs in 2009, and when he was 29, so he hit 33 homers before turning 30, and he's got 330 some after 30.
So here's our perfect offseason. We trade Kluber for either Bellinger. I really also like the Verdugo-Taylor combo.
Yeah.
So I have a starting right fielder now with Verdugo. Taylor can play some infield positions. Like, those are two good hitters. And then I signed Nelson Cruz, and I've added 10 or 12 million in salary. And then I have 12 million a year to pay out Avino or Dave Robertson. So my bullpen's better, my lineup's better, and I gave up Corey Kluber. And I'm as financially flexible as I was the year before.
And you haven't dipped into your prospect well at all, so you might have some flex in July.
And the Indians have added like four upper level 40 to 45 prospects this year who could break out. Like, Daniel Johnson's a breakout candidate of a prospect. Alex Call and Monasterio are also breakout prospect, like, type guys in double A. You have McKenzie, you have Nolan Jones, who's going to be playing in double A this year. I mean, I don't really care for Bobby Bradley. Don't tell Michael Bode or Bodie. I don't like platoon bats who strike out too much. Yu Chang.
That's the underrated part of the whole Edwin and Santana, is freeing up your roster flexibility. Getting rid of Alonso and Encarnacion and supplanting them with Edwin means you might be able to bring a Yu Chang up and give him some at-bats. Akron's going to be fun this year with all those guys. We'll have to go there and do a live podcast or something like that.
Absolutely. They have good food there.
I'm not going to call them the Arrows.
It's a nice park. It's a nice place to hang out.
It is. I haven't been there in about 20 years, but I remember it fondly. No.
So I guess we'll close, because I think that's the nature of podcasts. They have to end at some point, just like our lives. But our takeaways here are that Alex Call and Mr. Monasterio are interesting. Jake Bowers is a big league player. And the Indians still have a lot left to do. To plug work, read my Jake Bowers piece. To plug Gage's work, do you have something coming out soon?
I have no idea. Just go to Waiting for Next Year and read the Indians content. And all the content while we're here.
But I would say, I would tell you to follow Gage on Twitter, but he's never on Twitter. He's a monster. Nevertheless, this has been the EHC at WFNY.otherletters podcasts. And thanks for listening.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.